There are more political horse race polls out there than you can shake a stick at. But you want to know which party has the economic edge? We can tell you that. Our first national economic poll was released today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, October the 26th. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. And there are a couple of economic truisms that need to be said out loud as we get going today. Almost any way you slice it, the American economy is growing. We are adding jobs, not as many as we would like, but we are adding them. GDP, gross domestic product, is growing. Again, not as fast as we all would like, but it's growing. So, riddle me this. Why do so many people in this country feel so economically vulnerable? I'm glad you asked, because we have been wondering the same thing. So we went out and we asked people how their economy feels, how in the next year or so leading up to the election, they are going to be thinking about the economy in this country. It's the first ever Marketplace National Economic Poll done with our partners at Edison Research. Today is the beginning of our 2016 election coverage, the important economic stuff, not the silly horse race stuff I was talking about. We're kicking off a week of coverage about the findings on this Monday. Dave Shaw is our Washington bureau chief. He has been running the poll for us. Hey, Dave.
Hey, Kai.
We found that there's a lot of unease out there, right?
There's a lot of anxiety. People feel anxious. They feel stuck. They feel insecure. We asked a great question in here. Does your financial situation cause you to lose sleep? More than one in four of the people who responded said, yes, I am currently losing sleep over my financial situation.
And that's in an economy that's adding 125,000 jobs a month. It's the economy is growing, not as fast as we want, but people are lying awake at night because of money.
Yeah. And so, you know, behind all of these numbers, right, there are real people who are living this. And so Robert Wilson, we talked with him last week in Washington. He's 54. He works for a law firm, and he is feeling that.
What makes me most anxious is the thought of not being able to pay my bills. You know, that really, you know, keeps you up at night.
Not being able to pay your bills. Yeah. One of the reasons that you'd be stressed out about that is because your wages haven't gone up. He said he used to work for a company, his old job, that didn't believe in giving raises.
Wow.
We hadn't had a raise in 3 years. Then they finally gave us one, and it was 40 and a half cents.
I love that. 40 and a half cents.
You know, every penny counts.
That's right. There's also, and there's lots of numbers, as you said, there's also some divisions, some bifurcations in the American electorate out there along the economy. Run me down some of those.
Okay, so this is, to me, the most interesting thing that we found is, you know, we're used to talking about the divisions between Republicans, Democrats, that we're used to talking about the 99% and the 1%. But there are other divisions that are sort of hiding in plain sight in our economy. And one of them is the difference between hourly workers versus workers who are paid a salary. But this is one of the spots that there is a real divide in the survey in terms of the stress and the anxiety that hourly workers are feeling every month is so much greater than the stress and the anxiety that is being felt by people who know what their paycheck is going to be every week or every other week.
There's also an American dream question in here, right? It's you know, do you believe in the way the American economy is going, basically?
Yeah, it's interesting because there's a lot of anxiety and there's a lot of insecurity, but there's still a belief in the system. Among those that we surveyed, nearly 80% said hard work is more important than luck when it comes to achieving the financial situation that you want to have. That's a clear majority who say, you know what, I'll play by the rules of the system because I can get ahead.
Even for all the complaining we do about the American dream being dead, right?
Exactly. One interesting thing about that American dream question is the subgroup most likely to say it's alive and well is the youngest cohort. And these are the folks who've really taken it on the chin in the economy in the last 5 or 10 years.
Let me get you back up to the top and that idea that we started with of anxiety. We took some parts of this poll and we created a way to quantify how anxious people are. Tell us about the Marketplace Edison Research Economic Anxiety Index.
Okay, what this is it's a number. It goes from 0 to 100. And of the, you know, dozens of questions that we asked in the survey, we picked about 12. And depending on how you answered those 12, and depending on how stressed out you were in those answers, we assigned a numerical value to your economic stress and your economic anxiety. What was really interesting is you can use it to compare subgroups. When you look at the economic anxiety that different groups are feeling, you start to see some interesting divisions. And this is what we were talking about with hourly workers versus salaried workers, renters versus mortgage holders. It varies by race. People who identified in the survey as Hispanic score higher on this anxiety index than do people who are African-American or white. And it is highest among age groups on the in the 25 to 34 demographic. So when you start to compare subgroups, you really get a sense for who's more stressed out and who is bearing the brunt of the economic downturn as it exists still today.
And we should say we're gonna refine this through the year. We're doing this poll three more times before Election Day. And so that index will become ever more useful and refined. We've got all the data from it, and we've got the poll itself on our website, yes, marketplace.org.
And some schnazzy graphics.
As always, Dave Shaw is our Washington bureau chief. He's been running the poll for us. Dave, thanks very much.
Of course, Kai.
Once again, it is marketplace.org. There is also a spot, by the way, where you can tell us your story about how the economy feels to you, because that's what really matters. It's not jobs. It's not GDP. It's you and how you're feeling. Today on Wall Street, traders seem to be a tad anxious, actually waiting to see what Janet Yellen and the gang at the Fed are going to do with interest rates at their meeting tomorrow and Wednesday. We will have the details when we do the numbers. In a development that will surely be music to the ears of millions of school children all over this great land, the White House wants kids to spend less time on testing. President Obama said this weekend he thinks no more than 2% of classroom time ought to be spent on testing, and that test results should play a smaller role in how we judge education overall. It's not like the White House can wave its magic wand to make that happen, but also there is a whole lot of money circling in and around the testing industrial complex to keep it all going on. Marketplace's Adrian Hill has that part of the story.
School kids are an off-tested bunch.
The average kid in one of our schools will take about 112 standardized tests between pre-kindergarten and the time they graduate from high school.
Mike Casserly is the executive director of Council of the Great City Schools. He says the 112 doesn't include optional tests, school-developed tests, sample tests, AP tests.
The country spends about $2.5 billion on elementary and secondary classroom assessments a year.
Much of this goes to big testing companies like ETS and Pearson. And it sounds like a lot until you consider that we spend more than $600 billion a year on public education. Now, no one thinks the president's call to cut testing is going to make a big dent. Casserly says that eighth graders, the most tested group, spend only 2.3% of their time on mandatory tests. But if test scores do become less essential to how education is judged, that could have an economic impact on some school funding, some teacher salaries, and maybe your personal wealth.
A lot of this is a public shaming mechanism.
Matthew Chingos is a fellow at the Urban Institute. He says school test scores are published online and
parents use that information when they make decisions about where to send their kids to school. It gets reflected in real estate prices.
It's often much more expensive to live near a high-scoring school than a low-scoring one. But Chingos thinks limits on testing are much more about political posturing than meaningful change. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
There is news today from the credit card business through which a big, giant chunk of consumer spending in this country flows. USAA, one of the biggest issuers of credit and debit cards here, a firm that caters primarily to military and veterans, has just announced that it's ending a decades-long relationship with MasterCard and switching its customers over to Visa. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson has the details on that.
MasterCard says in its business, wins and losses happen. That it doesn't like losing, but this deal got to the point where the economics didn't work for it. Basically, shrug, no biggie.
Large issuing banks tend to pit MasterCard and Visa against each other in order to make sure they're getting the best terms and the best product.
Gilluria covers Visa and MasterCard for Wedbush Securities. He says this is a big deal because of USAA's size and the loyalty of its customers. And it shows how much muscle issuers and merchants now have over card networks, says Andrew Davidson with Mintel Comper Media. Brands like USAA or Capital One or Costco.
So we're seeing something of a shift in the balance of power. And I think as the landscape goes forward, we're going to see, you know, the networks really trying to fight to maintain their relevance, trying to, you know, really prove their value to their partners.
Because Davidson says consumers today often view Visa and MasterCard as pretty interchangeable. And new payment technologies might reduce the amount of transactions processed over card networks, says David Robertson. He's the publisher of the Nilson Report, which follows the credit card and debit card industry.
Things are loosening up in terms of the status quo. And what the knowledgeable players in this business are trying to do is to make sure they've got their back protected by gaining scale.
And in the race for scale, Robertson says Visa just added more than $75 billion of purchases each year at MasterCard's expense. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
If there's one thing you learn working at Marketplace, it's that it's never good to do a big economic story on the radio using only facts and figures. We wanted to put some voices to the numbers that we gathered in our poll with Edison Research. So we went out and we talked to a whole bunch of people all across the country. Here's what they had to say.
I'm kind of working on my business right now, and it's kind of building. So I'm not in the best financial situation, but I don't know. I think it'll be okay. I have a positive outlook on it.
The uncertainty of the future, I mean, you can dot all the I's and cross all the T's, but that's still not a guarantee that everything is going to work out the way you've planned.
There's a lot of advertisement and a lot of things that influence me every day to reach into my wallet and somehow spend money.
Basically, I just never have enough money, and so I'm used to that. You know, it never gets better, so it's what I expect.
I'm moderately anxious about my financial situation because we just bought a house.
The big house with the white picket fence, that's pretty much out of the question, you know.
Not feeling too anxious about the economic situation right now. Looking at where the economy and market has been in the past year, it seems like there's still reason for encouragement.
I think the idea of having a job makes me a little bit more confident in my future financially.
There's nothing that I can foresee that can prevent me from having a successful financial situation and for the rest of my life.
Luckily, we have savings accounts, so it's not that bad. That's why I was able to work part-time this year.
Times is getting hard, but I mean, I guess it'll get better in the long run, you know.
Well, I'm close to retirement, and I think my pension is safe.
Being retired on Social Security sucks, you know. You can't go out for dinner to a nice restaurant. I, you know, I could use a couple $100 more a month.
As Dave Shaw was talking about, some optimism and some anxiety. That was how the economy feels in Oakland, Atlanta, Washington, D.C., and Austin, Texas. Please do tell us how it feels to you. There's a place you can do it at our website, marketplace.org. Coming up.
Those laws of physics are different on mobile. In fact, you see a brand many times and you get more annoyed.
Yes, yes, you do. Hence ad blocking technology. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, a whole lot of nothing waiting on Janet and the gang. The Dow Industrial's off 23 points, about a 10%, closed at 17,623, did the blue chips. The NASDAQ up 2 points, less than a 10%, finished things at 5,034. The S&P 500 the other way, down 3 points, almost 0.2%, 2,071. Apple soured 3.2% today on fears that the tech giant's quarterly results, which are going to come out tomorrow, may be disappointing. Oh, horrors. Other tech stocks sparkled. Google's holding company, named Alphabet, although I think I already promised I was only going to say Google, so shame on me. It was up 1.6%. Microsoft trimmed 2.6%. Okay. Energy stocks lower on lower crude oil prices. Chevron trickle down 2.7%. ExxonMobil trickle down 2.1%. Auto parts chain Pep Boys revved up 23.3% today after it agreed to be acquired by the Japanese tire maker Bridgestone. Bridgestone rolled up 0.5%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.05%. And you, yes you, you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We are still in the middle of wildfire season out here in the West. In Northern California alone, more than 2,000 homes were destroyed. 5,000 homeowners' insurance claims were filed, all told, in two big fires last month. Insurers have given those homeowners more time to document things while speeding up their payout checks. But in one of the most devastating wildfire seasons in a long, long while, some people are finding it difficult and expensive to get any insurance coverage at all. Marketplace's Andy Euler has that story.
Simi Valley is a typical Southern California suburb of more than 100,000 people, less than an hour's drive from downtown Los Angeles. It's mostly densely built gated communities on quarter-acre lots separated by open grassland. It's suburbia, but they've still got to deal with wildfires, like the one that burned almost 200 acres next to Wood Ranch Country Club in August. Dave Hill meets me outside his home there. He and his wife have been here for 4 years. He points to a scorched hill less than a mile away and says that's the first fire he's heard of coming this close.
And it lit these whole hills up. I was still at work. My poor wife was scared to death. The neighbors next door knocked on the door and said, you know, you got to come out. Or they called her and said, come out to the front and look. And that entire hill was on fire.
The fire threatened 500 houses in Wood Ranch, but didn't burn any down. Yet Hill says his insurance company was quick to let him know he should start looking for another policy.
And I just renewed in June. It's a one-year renewal. And when this happened, I think it was August 14th, about a week later in the mail, I got a letter saying, because of the recent fire, that they weren't going to renew me next June.
In recent years, millions of people have moved closer to wildland in the West. Warmer temperatures and drought have also expanded the fire zone. Homes that weren't at risk last year might be today. Cher Russell isn't all that surprised to hear that some homes in Wood Ranch aren't getting policies. She's an agent with Simi Valley Insurance down the street.
Your premium could possibly increase, or you can get a non-renewal letter because the company has decided not to write homeowners insurance in that area due to wildfire.
Insurance companies can do this because they have a lot more data. I mean, 10 years ago, you couldn't Google a picture of your house. Now we do it all the time. Russell says they get updates from the companies they write policies for every day.
And they tell us what zip code is not accepting new business for homeowners insurance. Certain areas, we have been informed, cannot write new business.
The insurance companies have access to data from Cal Fire and the National Forest Service. They use it to develop models that predict what areas are at risk. That's why they eliminate entire zip codes at a time.
That information allows the insurer to price the risk accordingly.
Nancy Kincaid is a spokesperson for the California Department of Insurance.
Instead of spreading the risk among lots of homeowners where everybody pays maybe a little more, you're able to single out those homes that are at greatest risk. Those homeowners will pay more.
Insurance companies still want to write policies. Today, they're just able to be more selective, and consumers don't really have access to the same data.
And remember that insurance is still about business, and insurers are in the business to make money and provide coverage for people. So it's not the best for the marketplace if you're not writing anywhere.
So what happens if nobody will write you a policy? It's a mortgage requirement. In California, the last resort is what's called a Fair Plan policy. If you're an insurance company in California, you have to be a member of the Fair Plan Association and contribute. It's basically a pool of money to provide basic fire insurance for property owners who can't get policies. Think of it as catastrophic health insurance for your house. Often, if folks under the Fair Plan have to file a claim, they find that they're underinsured. Dave Hill doesn't think it's going to get to that for him, but it's something he never thought he'd have to deal with again.
I mean, it's not like we're in Big Bear or something like that where we've got pine trees all around us and you are in danger of getting burned out. And they've been doing, they started brush clearing back in the spring, but I'm dealing with it now. Or I'm going, well, I'm, you know, it's down the road, but I'm going to have to deal with it next June, yeah. I'll have to go find someone else that'll write a policy for you.
Unlike flood and earthquake, fire is still built into the homeowner's insurance package. Making it a separate policy could be a tough sell for insurance companies. But as drought persists, fire zones continue to grow, and more claims are filed, individual fire insurance doesn't seem all that far off, at least not in the West. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Advertising on the web and on mobile devices is a $60 billion a year industry. A $60 billion a year industry that most people find completely annoying. That helps explain why ad blocking technology, which just like it sounds, lets you not see banners on web pages or pop-ups when you're on your phone, why it has suddenly gone mainstream. And in that cause and effect way that capitalism has, the ad industry is now a little bit worried about its future. Our senior tech correspondent Molly Wood explains how that industry is responding and how one startup is trying to build a whole new type of ad.
We've all had this happen before. You're standing in line for coffee, just trying to catch up on a little celebrity gossip on your phone. And then here come the pop-ups. You try to X out, but that launches a new page. And then all of a sudden you're in the app store. By the time you get to the story you're trying to read, you're out of time. And no, you have no idea what any of those ads were for.
We've been ad blocking with our eyeballs for a long time now, and we never really pay attention to these things.
That's Brian Wong. He's the CEO of a San Francisco company called Keep that's trying to reinvent digital advertising. He says the thinking used to be that the more times you advertise a product, the more likely people are to buy it.
This applied really well in old media. Those laws of physics are different on mobile. In fact, you see a brand many times and you get more annoyed.
Keep gets around that by offering rewards to people inside of the apps they're using, like a running app, for example. When you finish a workout and log your miles, you might see a pop-up ad for a free Gatorade.
Or a free song download, for example, or a trial to music subscription, or something that, again, is aligned to fitness and that moment that you just engaged in.
They're ads, but they come with a payoff. Wong says all this irritation with mobile advertising is good for business.
I'm stoked that this is happening.
But the rest of the industry is much less stoked. For them, the realities are just starting to sink in.
I think it's safe to say that we're experiencing some turbulence and disruption.
Scott Cunningham is a senior vice president at the Interactive Advertising Bureau, which sets technical standards for the industry. In a recent blog post outlining a new set of best practices for digital ads, the IAB admitted, quote, "We messed up." And it said the industry let ads get too annoying. So the new guidelines call for ads that don't show up too often, take over entire pages, track you all over the web, or suck up your mobile bandwidth.
The industry over the last 6 years has experienced the industrial age of automation. And as smart and as sophisticated as that automation is, we need to be just as smart, if not better, at knowing where we need to put the limits in place.
But some companies aren't waiting for new guidelines. They're cracking down already. Google, Facebook, and Twitter all have policies that don't charge advertisers for ads that load on a page but don't get seen. Shannon Reed is a digital media buyer at the agency MEC. She says that new requirement, called viewability, will have a big impact.
We're going to see fewer ads out of the publishers because they're going to figure out the ones that actually work on a viewability, and then they're just going to get rid of the rest of them because nobody's paying for them.
Reed says the ads that remain will be less intrusive. Think native advertising, which is customized content that looks like a news article or an entertainment video, or ads that are
so close to understanding what it is that this customer is truly interested in and truly wants that that message resonates and makes them happy.
Happy about advertising. Well, we'll be waiting.
Molly, small Americano.
Yes, you have the art light.
In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood for Marketplace.
Final note on the way out today. First of all, a correction. I talked Friday about the brand new Krispy Kreme Challenge Children's Specialty Clinic at the University of North Carolina. $2 million to support the clinic and which earned the name change had been raised by students. I had said they were UNC students. They were actually NC State students. Apologies to all my Tar Heel friends. I understand that is a grievous insult. Also, this from the Marketplace desk of the future is upon us today. Walmart applied to the FAA for permission to test drones for home delivery. Apparently, the company's been doing indoor tests for months now. Amazon, as you know, is already working on that, so you got to figure now it's going to happen. A Walmart spokesperson said this today. There is a Walmart within 5 miles of 70% of the U.S. population, which creates some unique and interesting possibilities for serving customers with drones. What, I'm obliged to ask, could possibly go wrong? Finally, this, before we go. Tomorrow, as we continue with the findings from our first ever national economic poll, that split in hourly versus salaried workers that Dave Shaw talked about a little bit up at the top of the program. Coming up tomorrow from Noel King, why people getting paid by the hour feel so stuck. All righty, got to go. The Dow off 23 points today, a 10%. The NASDAQ up 2 points, less than a tenth. The S&P 500 off 3 points, almost 0.2%. Hello, Janet Yellen. We're waiting for you. Our daily production team includes Tommy Andres, Bridget Bodner, Robert Garova, Mukta Mohan, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.